As retailers entered the lockdown in March 2020, a small, diverse group of Canadian thought leaders gathered to virtually speculate, collaborate, and share their insights on the waves of disruption facing retailers. The Business of Retail podcast emerged as an unflinching strategic alternative to the conventional discourse, revealing challenges in the headlines and exploring new, unconventional paths for all facets of the retail industry. Now, here's the panel.
Welcome to the Business of Retail podcast. I'm Craig Patterson. I'm joined here today with Gary Newbery, George Minakakis, Christine Cohen, and David Ian Gray. Welcome, everyone.
Hello.
Hello.
Today, we're going to talk about department stores. I think it's a very interesting topic, something I'm personally interested in. For generations, department stores were an integral part of our community as well as the retail industry. And as of late, department stores don't seem to have nearly the same prominence to the point that they're almost non-existent in many places. So we're going to talk a little bit about department stores, what happened, where they are, and what the future is, how are they going to reorientate themselves to be something compelling again in the eyes of the consumer in the age of Amazon.
So there are no more doormen left, are there, for department stores anywhere? Maybe Holt Renfrew had one. I don't know if they still do on Bloor. They don't.
Only the valet parking people. That's right. They used to have a doorman in Toronto and one in Vancouver that I was familiar with.
So that's it.
I wrote a business op-ed in something like 1998 or 1999 predicting that there would be no more department stores by 2010. So I was wrong, but
you had the help of a great recession behind you as well on that prediction, and it still survived somehow.
Well, and I my gut tells me it's surviving based on real estate economics, which is not my forte, as opposed to it being a viable in-demand consumer-led retail concept. And I'd be curious. I know Craig's bit of a student of the history of retail and department stores, but I think it's probably worth starting there, because that in the beginning they were an incredibly innovative concept. They were, and not just for shopping, I think they became a cultural moment in time where it meant something for people to be going to the department store to meet up, etc. So maybe Craig, you can start with a little storytell of where we've come from.
Yeah. I mean, department stores started basically in the late 1800s, depending where you were. Places like New York City, Paris, and London were certainly the first centers to be seeing these concepts. So before that, we had general retail, smaller stores, probably nothing too exciting overall, fairly utilitarian. And these entrepreneurs out there developed this large format model where they created large spaces, sometimes over a million square feet. Welcome different vendors into those department store spaces, eventually in some cases taking over departments and running them as their own curated departments. So over the decades, they became integral to even the identity of cities throughout North America. I'll expand just beyond Canada in that respect, because in Canada we had less of a diversity of chains. We had really strong retailers like the Hudson Bay Company, and Eaton's, which was national, as well as some of the more local chains in Western Canada, being Woodward's, Eastern was Simpson's and Morgan's. So the department store model really morphed over the years, became very, very popular. It was what brought people downtown. And then came the suburban shopping centers and other things that eventually started killing department stores. I could go on, because the death of or the slow suicide of the department store, I think, has been, concerning, but it's now part of our history. So we had, in some cases, department stores developing the very shopping centers that we're starting to put them under. So in Western Canada, Woodward's had developed Park Royal and Oak Ridge Center, and others in Alberta. We had Simpson's in Ontario developing shopping centers as well. And really what I think shopping centers did when they started developing, or sorry, when department stores started developing shopping centers, they in many respects created competition for themselves. Brands were able to stand out on their own and have retail locations in these shopping centers. It also pulled traffic from downtowns, and the suburban department stores were, nearly as interesting for the most part. when compared to the downtown stores. But in the end, in many cases, as we started seeing, especially American chains falling, sales in the downtown stores were less than the suburban stores. In some cases, like I think it was LS Ayers in Indianapolis, I think it was, one suburban store was doing $50 million a year in 1993, and the downtown store, which is 700,000 square feet, was doing $20 million. It was absolutely awful. So, you know, it's times really changed. And then on top of that, department stores started discount floors, which became, you know, Nordstrom Rack, for example. Dayton's had created, is now Target. It's really interesting. You know, we saw category killers coming in. We saw so much competition from discounters. And then the consumer changed because until the 1950s, consumers in North America spent generally between 12 and 14% of their gross household income on clothing. And quite often that was in department stores. Department stores were the first thing to introduce brands into the market. And times have really changed. I'm just floored with, how few department stores we have left.
Well, Sears, even at Sears' demise in Canada, the sales volume, the unit volume was still quite substantive through that chain. But I guess the question is it missed? Is Eaton's missed? And when I say missed, are they missed not from a cultural perspective where we kind of glorify that flagship that's downtown, the iconic view of a department store, but it strikes me that the consumer's done fine. So I guess the question is, who does it matter most to that department stores continue on?
It's interesting. If you look at Europe in particular, and London, the downtown flagship store is, you think about Harrods, you think about Selfridges, they're still the icons that people want to go. They've almost become a tourist attraction. So people want to go there. They want to see the store. There's a story behind it. It's still, the food courts are unbelievable. There's just a lot of really interesting things that they have. And if you think about Canada, we've kind of lost a bit of that sheen. And, the downtown core had that. And now it just seems, to your point, they're moving out to the suburbs or they're moving into, more kind of iconic areas. You think about South Granville or other areas. In Vancouver or in Toronto. And it's just, those big department stores, number one, we couldn't really manage the level of department stores. I mean, I used to work at Woodward's at one point when I was a teenager, and we had Eaton's and the Bay, and they kind of overexpanded, and then there was nothing really special anymore. So it's interesting. I love hearing Craig talk about the history of it, especially in Canada, because I remember those stores and I remember shopping there. And I remember when, they started to close down, and, now it's really the Hudson's Bay is the icon, and, there's a lot of challenge there, with the Hudson's Bay, and it's just, that's the heritage and history of Canada. So it's going to be really interesting to see how things unfold.
And I've got some insider information on one of their flagships. I couldn't believe it, but what they're doing in downtown Montreal, it's an old Morgan's store. It's about 655,000 square feet. The plan is to basically downsize the retail to about 250,000 square feet over three floors, including the basement. They're going to convert the upstairs into office and other uses and then throw a tower onto the back of the building. And I think it's a bit disappointing because one of the advantages to a department store is having a lot of space to be able to do interesting things. And basically now the Hudson Bay flagship in downtown Montreal is going to be smaller by 100,000 square feet compared to the Yorkdale store, which is a suburban unit in Toronto. And now the Vancouver store could be in line for a size reduction as well. And who knows about Queen Street, because already Queen Street being the Toronto flagship, for those who don't know, that store already was downsized to a degree by adding a WeWork co-working space in there, not as drastically as what's going to happen to the Montreal store, which is going to shrink it to, the size of a larger suburban store. It's really quite shocking, like David, you said about the real estate play. That's what seems to be happening, at least here right now. And I find that a bit disappointing personally.
I think in some ways it's disappointing if they're going to take the rationalization of the sales space just to mean compress the SKUs into a smaller space, as opposed to throw everything up in the air and think about what categories we need to be in to be successful in the 2020s, and then curate the assortment within each category as part. If that's stirring this movement, then you know we I'm sure we'll come up with whole ranges of different things that they might want to think about in that context. But if it is just like cramming it in, I've been to that Montreal store a couple of times and I was single-mindedly under-impressed. And that included a visit, I think, in 2017 and then 2019 after we had Helena do her thing, her magic. And I saw no obvious change to any aspect of that store. If they're just going to cram it in, I just think that's probably the death knell for that store. And it's any sense of relevancy or popularity that may hold in that community.
Economically, George, I don't know if you know, but economically, could a one-off major market downtown department store be viable as a singular entity without the network of suburban stores adjacent to that model? Like, can you, Christine's point about the Harrods, how often can that work? And I guess what size of city can support that would be the question.
You know, I've always contended that department stores, you probably only needed a handful of them in each city, in a city, right? So if you're like Toronto, maybe two, you know, Vancouver, one of a brand, of a single brand, right? Montreal, one. Any more than that, it's just watering down the experience. You can't execute flawlessly in every large location like that. It's almost impossible to do it. And the cost, the economics of trying to mimic a Harrods or Selfridges in that environment at every location, the cost would be astronomical. You would be bankrupt a lot sooner than it is today. So, but I have to comment, you know, in order for that to happen, we have to fall in love with department stores again. And I don't think the public is there anymore. I think part of, you know, when Craig's talking about the history, the one thing he didn't touch on was that, and I'm sure he would have, I think you touched it a bit, is that department stores saw Walmart as a threat. And they all started moving in a direction of becoming discounters themselves. So they diluted their whole experience over time. And the public just said, okay, so what? You know, this isn't exactly the kind of experience that I was looking for in a department store. And everybody, you know, that was shopping in the 90s and the 80s, you know, in the early 2000s, they were old enough to, or young enough to remember what it was like in the 60s and the 70s, right? Which was a better customer experience. So now you're saying to people who are in their 20s and their 30s, who do not have any recollection of that, you know, how they feel about department stores, probably not such a big thing, right? Unless they go to Europe.
Yeah, we did a Dig 360 did a pretty deep dive research piece with Leger on the Canadian department store scene maybe about 4 years ago when Sears was kind of in trouble. And part of the findings was, you know, Hudson Bay would be next. But it was interesting the number of people that were turning to the likes of Marshalls and Winners as an example. And there, you know, that kind of hunt and peck shopping isn't for everyone. But I guess the question then is, how do you define a department store? You know, maybe it's just morphing. And is Walmart not a department store?
Yeah. I think the other thing that's interesting is the product mix. So if you think back in the day, you would go and buy your mattress at a department store, you get all your furniture, you'd register there. And there was so much that the department store was trying to be everything to everybody. And now we're seeing so much success with, you know, direct-to-consumer brands and mattresses and other things like that. And I think, you know, especially the flagship, yeah, you can represent well, but as you start to morph to the smaller footprints, then it's a watered-down message. And then I also think we're just as consumers going to department stores for different needs now than we might have before. One thing department stores, I think, do really well is, like, you think about the cosmetics area of a department store, and that really is the cash cow for the business. And then some of the fashion departments, and I think ones that do well, like a Holt Renfrew, have shop in shops. They have, you know, great branded stories in there. They're not trying to kind of curate. And I think back in the day, it was curating trying to be everything to everybody. And I think, you know, consumers are evolving and they're looking more to specialty and finding different ways to shop. So, you know, I think there are a lot of challenges with the old model of a department store. And to your point, David, like there are places like, you know, Target or other stores that are offering up a feel for that, but in a different way and maybe in more of a discounted way. And so how do you compete? Like, you know, you just can't have that model of the old department store and sell mattresses and furniture and be super competitive in this landscape.
Well, and I think when it was at its peak, as Craig indicated, it was really innovative. And you didn't have a lot of competitive choice, right? So as a shopper, you'd make a day of it. You'd go, even if you lived in the burbs, you might go to the flagship, you'd have lunch there. You could get everything under one roof. Mm-hmm. But Craig made an excellent point, which is they cannibalized themselves when they got behind the mall, the suburban mall concepts, because that is basically the same from a shopper's point of view. It's the same concept, is you're in a place and you can get everything.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think my position I had in the late 90s, and it's probably still there, is by and large, it's a nostalgia issue. I don't know if there's a way to reinvent other than to take the real estate and do something with the real estate. Having said that, I am a fan of some of those flagships or Katowice in Berlin, or like they're exciting and they're fun to go to.
But and they're high end.
Yeah, they're high end. And I didn't drop a lot of money in there. I had some food and it was fun to go to, and I bought a couple things, but I don't know the economic viability of those. So I don't know, maybe it's a short discussion today.
Well, not at all. I actually think we had a great discussion offline last week around department stores, and it was heading towards some ideas as to what actually represents successful selling via a department store format. And we looked at things like Holt Renfrew and Nordstrom particularly, where it's a different experience to going to, as you might suggest, at Walmart, maybe Canadian Tire, which we might actually define those and Winners, etc., as department stores with different price pointing strategies. And I think that my takeaway from the conversation was, and it was really supported within a day, it's almost as if Jeff Jeanette was listening into our conversation, because it was almost a carbon copy of what we just said, which was go up market, go smaller format. We added in store into our conversation, but appeal to the 1%. That's where the money is. If you're going to do something, do it well. Don't do it in this kind of floppy, sloppy kind of way that you're trying to, you know, if you're Hudson Bay Company with your heritage, you don't look at Walmart, you don't look at potentially Target coming into Canada back in 2012-13 as competitors. You certainly don't look at Sears, but they did. And this is more of a melee, but, you know, they've lost their way.
I think getting our heads around what are we talking about when we lament failing the department store concept, because you're touching on some aspects, you know, some models that are not typically associated. So like, would Urban Outfitters in its prime be a department store? You could argue it is. The new school version that I toured in the US at the end of last year was Neighborhood Goods, which was super exciting. Like that was a whole new kind of Gen Y millennial take on what would be a curated department store of up and coming brands. So maybe the starting point is, what do we mean by department store?
I think in a very general way, it's multiple categories, which may be household orientated, or most likely household orientated, that you can just come in, browse around. Ideally, you might be able to sit down and have something to eat, but less so now. Certainly was in the UK. Always had a restaurant in our Marks and Spencer's, British Home Stores, Selfridges and the like. I think what we've, you know, the whole definition of department stores is kind of, that one that we say, oh, these are off-price retailers. No, they might be department stores. These ones might be multi-category specialists, whatever, No, it might be department stores. And I think that we have a lack of clarity as to where the boundaries of one format is and when the next one actually starts. And I think that that is half of the demise of the concept or the format of department stores. And we may serve ourselves some benefit here to actually clarify what is it and how might an aspect of it, maybe the high price pointing, need to look like to differentiate itself from the, I would say, the mass market version of department stores.
And I'll just add to throw into the discussion, does the shopper care about that debate?
You know, I think they do. But I think what you have to do is, you know, you have to reinvent the department store, but not going forward. You have to go step back into its past, pick up part of the heritage to make sense, and tell that story and build from there with the future technology, innovation, build it all, put it all together. Because when you walked into a department store, we weren't all, you know, we're a little young enough or even born yet, but 70 years ago, right? You got into a department store, you had an experience. From the moment you walked, someone opened the door, you walked in, you heard the music, the scents of the perfumes, the colognes picked you up. You know, they literally carried you. Somebody once told me, the cologne in the department store carried me through the store, right? I mean, you think about that image. That doesn't happen anymore. But if you want to survive, you have to bring that back to life. And you have more of an opportunity to do that today with technology than you had 20 years ago, right? Yes, you cannot do that from a capital investment point of view. There is no way to do that in every location. Mm. But boy, if you could walk into a downtown location and it takes you through that store with a vision, and you tell a story, right? And it's every quarter that you tell a different story, and it's a seasonal one, but it's aspirational. It's about the future and it's an imagination, right? You're bringing life forward to everybody. Right, but you are an innovator, and you're telling a story of the future. What are they doing today, and what have they done for the last 20 years? Hordes of inventory, discounts. You know, I don't know what the tonnage of clothing would be in a department store in every single unit, but it must be astronomical. And how much of it moves? Very little. So I think that you know you can is about how much of a risk is someone willing to take. And to, you know, JCPenney being bought out, we said earlier, 700 stores for $800 million. What a steal. You know, at the end of the day, if they're going to hang on to that brand in some way, then they need to create a couple of those locations need to become heritage, right? There need to be, you want the stores that tell the story of the brand so that you can rebuild the connection. Otherwise, why did you bother doing this? Right? Why continue?
And I absolutely agree with you. I think one of the other big things is the service piece and having in-store, you know, back in the day. And I keep referencing Selfridges. And if you've had a chance to ever watch that series with Jeremy Piven, it's unbelievable. But back to the experience and to your point, like, you know, they'd have a circus elephant come into the store and they would do it up, but they also knew their customers and their consumers and they tailored to them. So not only was your experience going in the shop, they knew who you were, they had products for you, like really thought through like the consumer experience and you felt special going into those stores. And I think we lost that. I mean, you go to the Bay downtown and it's just, you're struggling, number one, to find like someone on the floor to help you. And then number two, like, where are you going to go to pay for it? Like, it just, we don't make it easy for consumers to go in and experience something exciting and interesting. And then, you know, the staff are so underrepresented on the floor. And again, going back, you know, cosmetics is the only place where you've got like a million people all over you, but you go to any other department of the stores and it's just like a ghost town. And I completely agree with you. Like, there's an opportunity on the heritage side, and I've always said this, I love the Hudson's Bay and I love the Hudson's Bay product and what it represents to Canada and our culture. You know, if there was a way that they could do that and make it really special, you know, we'd all be there. We'd all be excited about it again. But we also had a really good conversation the last time we talked about stores in Asia and how, you know, they've sort of held on to that department store feel. And really, it's become, you know, they lease the space to the retailer, and then they come in and you have this amazing brand experience with their staff manning it. And that's an opportunity, I think, you know, that could potentially help.
I think that, I think that model is what you're alluding to, or when you talked about Holtz and others, where it's concessions within the concept. I can see that model making a little bit more sense economically than taking on all the inventory. I still like Nordstrom, to be honest, but I've seen them cut back on their floor staff, which is, that's scary, because I think that is the differentiator. And Hudson Bay cutting back on staff, what makes them any better than shopping online for the cheapest pair of Levi's then?
Yeah.
If you don't have that human element.
What's interesting with Nordstrom too is they, they used to have kind of a house and home department, and many of the stores down in the US, it's sort of shrunk, but they still have an online presence. So that's another opportunity, as, you know, they're trying to be everything to everyone. Figuring out what fits in brick and mortar and then what is a digital or a DTC play, there's opportunities there as well. I mean, that puts it into a different realm, but I think they've got to be more innovative and more creative. And I agree with George, like, too many, we've got to cut it back. We've got to really focus and make them special again.
And to David's point, because we had that discussion, it was like, what's different between going into Hudson Bay and not knowing how to search, because you can't actually speak to somebody, and actually going on to Amazon and keying in and getting 40,000 SKUs back? There's no differentiating difference between those two experiences. I think they've lost, many department stores, I'm not just singling out Hudson Bay, just kind of lost their way in their sort of go large strategy. Pack as much in as you can, sell everything you can to anybody. I think that they need to really, if they're going to survive this period of time and come out, winning, they have to look at the whole business model completely differently to whatever they've done in the past.
David mentioned Nordstrom's, and 30 years ago, it was staple diet within the company for everybody to study up on Nordstrom's and how they serve the public. So we saw videos of, shoe salesmen for within the women's department section, $100,000 a year. A guy returning a tire and Nordstrom doesn't sell tires. All those stories, about customer experience. And I think Tom Peters was the person who's also talked about Nordstrom's as well in high regard. But that was in the day when service really mattered, right? And it was something that you cared for. But I think Christine, you mentioned earlier about everybody going to, or maybe it was David, you're going to all these treasure hunting and you to TJ Maxx and wherever else you're going to go to find a deal. I think that environment has killed off the need for service in some public's opinion. And it's unfortunate because you're willing to trade off service for a low price. And I think that's part of the problem. And society has made that happen themselves. And if you end up, I'll say this, you're probably the only one who'll say it. If you're a consumer and you didn't get great service because you paid a low price, that's why. It's just, well, there's no secret to this.
I don't know if it's chicken and egg. Like, maybe over time, our general experience with service has got so degraded that we don't believe there's such a thing, or maybe there's a generation who's never seen it. I do think that there are segments that still value that, and they'll have their own salesperson that's their contact at high-end stores. But when you think about physical retail, you need a big enough population concentration to carve out business from that. And I don't think that allows for those kind of stores to be dotting across every community in Canada. So I something got lost along the way, and whether it's resuscitating a Hudson Bay, or maybe I mentioned Neighborhood Goods earlier just because I thought it was, I don't know economically how they're doing, but smaller footprint featuring a lot of trunk shows and pop-ups of up and coming brands, just a fresh feel and with a much younger demographic, that might take off for a while, but maybe they're going to run into the same problem as they expand. So I don't know if there's an answer.
I think the answer is in finding that one, you know, markets where that 1% exists. I know if that's downtown or in a particular physical area where you have to do some kind of freestanding store where the only thing you do in that store is luxury everything, luxury service, luxury products, the whole thing. And you can link it in with the internet and you do it by appointment. You do everything about exclusivity. I think there's enough money. I suspect there's enough money in the 1%. Those people who don't want to go to Walmart for their sort of multi-category experiences, we won't even get the product they're looking for. I think as we go through pandemic, we will have that K-shaped recovery where the poor get poor and the rich get supremely more richly, more rich. I think that there is a market which will develop for high-end, luxury, high-service kind of propositions in a smallish format, exclusive entry. I think there's probably an opportunity there for the more forward-thinking retailers who might want to get into that space and allow, if Hudson Bay aren't able to get into that space, to allow them to form part of that mass market to compete against Walmart. And this is maybe they've already got there and said, well, our competition is Walmart, is Canadian Tire, is, you know, off-price retailing. And let's just get on with it. Let's run promotions every other couple of weeks or whatever, 70% off our product. Let's just wheel a load of inventory in, discount it, mark it down, get, you know, it's a throughput business. It's nothing about any memorable experience in that.
But if the brands themselves are trying to make a play for direct to consumer, doesn't that play into this in the long arc? You know, and maybe that's where someone has to be looking at what are up and coming brands that don't have that their own retail footprint yet, rather than going after the typical names that you see again and again and again.
Although consumers want those brands, right? The brands have become so strong on their own that consumers are loyal to them, and that's why they'll go to a discounter and buy them and not care about that retail experience. It's like, I got my X brand, you know, shoes that I really wanted, you know, whatever that might be. One thing I've thought about with retail, just having studied it literally since I was a kid, and I'm turning 44 pretty soon. So it's been a kid.
Hold on a second, yeah. Let's see if I can remember when I was 44. Yeah, all right.
Jeez, wow. But one thing I found was, you know, when I would go into some of the good department stores, there was this wow factor. You know, you'd actually get goosebumps and think, I'm in a really special place.
Right.
And part of that, oddly enough, I think was the architecture, where we respond to our environments, I think, far more than we realize. If we're in a beautiful place, we're likely to, you know, have a positive experience. If we're in a place that's not so nice, we're not going to get that. And what's interesting, I think, is I still go into a Le Maison Simons store.
I was going to say Simons. There you go.
Yeah, I actually get that feeling still. That feeling when I was a kid, when I got excited about retail, I'll go into Simons and I'm like, oh, this is there's a little bit of wonderment in this store. And, you know, the product is great, but also it's something more. It's the visuals that are there. On Saturday, I was in Saks Fifth Avenue in downtown Toronto, and every time I go in there, I say, "What's wrong with this store?"
Right?
Yeah, and you know,
they never got it.
No, and part of it is what they did is they slapped a bunch of paint on the old Simpsons store. I think it's haunted, by the way, but just the feeling. But you know, it's over 100. I think it was built in 1898. It's a very old building. If you look at it, what it looks like they've done is they've taken fixtures and they've slapped them into an old box that's over 100 years old, and they've just painted it. So I noticed the paintwork was kind of shoddy, and I thought, well, and then the carpets are a bit dirty. Like it looks like an upscale Bay store with Bottega Veneta and Fendi. I mean, you know, which is what the Bay does not carry generally, right? But I was kind of disappointed with what I saw with Saks Fifth Avenue, and I was reacting to that environment. And
it was like that when they launched it. Like, you would think if you're going to launch the concept, you'd at least at that point make it the best it can be. And that internal entranceway didn't make any sense, right?
Yeah, and it was value engineered. That's a very polite way of saying they found ways to cheap out. I'll say it bluntly like that. I David, as you know, because I was working with Dig360 on a project, I flew out to Toronto to go to the opening of Saks Fifth Avenue in 2016 in February, very cold. A friend of mine who is involved in construction and fixturing, we drove around, he's showing me around, and he looked up at the store and he says, look at that sign. He says, oh my God, I hope that's temporary. And this is the exterior of the building. We weren't even inside. He says, oh my God, what have they done here? This isn't good. And I thought, oh, you're just being picky. I'm sure it's fine. And then we went into the store the next morning. They welcomed guests in and he came in afterwards. And then another merchandiser, I won't say her name, but she came in as well. And she said, oh my God, look at these hangers. She said,
the hangers, yeah.
These are so cheap. These look awful. There's no Saks Fifth Avenue on the label. It looks like something that you might see at Winners, except Winners might even have better branded ones. You know, and Richard Baker was saying, well, this Saks Fifth Avenue is going to be the most luxurious store in Canada. And I walk into a Holt Renfrew and I get that sense of wonderment. I mean, Holt Renfrew has managed to curate an environment which could compete with shopping centers, if you think about it, because Holt Renfrew now is, well, you know, brands are demanding to have their own leased spaces. Holt Renfrew has an opportunity to create a clustering. And what we've found with places like the Yorkdale Shopping Center in Toronto is clustering works, because when people know that they can come and get their favorite brands in one place, they're going to go there. So I see that as being the opportunity for the department store, but the brands have to be on board, and probably they're going to be high margin and expensive brands. So that's kind of where things are going. And one more thing I was going to say too, Gary, you were talking about, you know, the 1% having these, you know, highly curated stores. I mean, I find it interesting in Canada, most of those unfortunately went bankrupt. Leonie's was one example in Vancouver. We had Ira Berg and Creed's in Toronto. We had Shea Cather in Toronto, Montreal. We have a few of these. Bannerman's in Peterborough is still a store like that. There's another one, I think Kingsnail's in London. Actually, I think they might have closed. But the United States has a lot of these stores, but very often they're not downtown because the downtowns have decayed and are perceived as being unsafe. So now you've got them in, like, you know, in Tulsa, there's a Galleria that has one of these stores. Some of them are in strip malls. They're near rich people in strip malls, and they're successful stores, but they're not department stores. They're, you know, 20,000 square foot fashion retailers that, you know, women and some men go to buy their fine goods.
Mm-hmm. Guys, this has been an incredible conversation. We got to wrap it up. So any parting thoughts?
Well, just that if anyone's listening as a podcast, as opposed to the visual, when Craig referenced Richard Baker's view of Saks being ultra luxury, there were four people in unison shaking their heads.
And it wasn't good.
It wasn't, yeah.
And I still can't put my finger on it fully. I mean, I really want to love the store. I think Sherway's better, but there's just something's missing. I don't know what, like I said, I'm like, is it haunted? I have no idea. But the Calgary store, I feel the same way. So it can't be. That can't be the reason.
I'll give you my kind of sum up on department stores, and it's held from the late 90s, which is, I think it's human nature to get enamored with something that got built, and then all your energy is around how to tweak it or fundamentally preserve it. And sometimes things just have an arc, and it's time for a rebirth. And I remember meeting George Heller in the late 90s, who was the CEO at the time of the Bay, Hudson Bay Company. And I said, you guys were the company of adventurers. The oldest incorporated company in the world. And you opened up the fur trade, and you're these merchant traders who built new frontiers. Are you going to go and take that into China? And I was being provocative, right? But at the time in the late 90s, you go, why not take that brand story and just start going back to your merchant trading roots? And he looked at me like I was absolutely nuts. But he was focused on how to open up more Dartmouth and, you know, small Canadian Zellers-like department stores. And I don't get it. I think it's got to be bigger. You've got to reinvent, and the reinvention has to come from something that's a bigger level concept than just how do we make use of the retail space and keep it running.
I think that just mindful that we just need to wrap this up. You mentioned ARC, and as you guys know, kind of landing on this retail life retail site concept life cycle, where, you know, many formats have been in kind of terminal decline and they've been cost cutting like a crazy. They should do the reinvention, and that's what department stores need to be. And the reinvention on this, I think from this conversation, is go luxury, go high service, go for that 1%. If you can figure that one out and what that really looks like on the ground and innovate in that space, I think that that's a winning formula.
And I think luxury would work because most of the other sectors are already tapped out in terms of offerings. Mid-price fashion isn't as much in vogue, and we still have stores. The low, you know, off-price and discount are probably saturated at this point, from Dollarama to Miniso to Costco and Walmart. One thing about luxury is people still buy it, those that have money and those that aspire to have the brands. Also, in a market like Canada, which is smaller, we don't always have a market for a standalone Goyard store or, you know, some of these standalone brands that, you know, may not yet look to Canada. So the department store, which would probably be Holt Renfrew, because now the brands are going to want their own space, they're able to come into the Canadian market and operate there. So, you know, you go to Vancouver and where is Bottega Veneta? You have to go to Holt Renfrew. Where is Loro Piana, the cashmere brand? You have to go to Holt Renfrew. I think it's brilliant though, because now the department store is competing against, you know, the shopping center that put them under at one point. But again, it's the concession model. I think the Hudson Bay Company is looking at moving into that as well. There'll be some more announcements there, but really we're talking to a degree about real estate. I think on the other hand, we're talking about branding, you know, being important in the eyes of the consumer. And then a whole nother conversation is what do department stores do around the online model, like what Bon Marché has done in Paris, by creating a luxury marketplace, which is highly elevated and has an online concierge service. And it'll be interesting to see what happens with department stores in the decades to come, if they even exist.
You know, I as I'm listening to all of you, all I can think of is in the 1920s, most likely, you know, the department stores back then were in their heyday, right? And you earned an income, whatever that might have been, and to buy a home might have been 2 to 3 times, maybe 4 times, your income. Okay. Today, your income could be X and a cost of a home can be 20 to 30 times your income. So there is no way that you can have that many department stores in the marketplace. The 1%, although wealthy, I've seen research that said that they're not the ones that are buying luxury, right? They're not the ones that are doing that. A lot of the people who are buying luxury are the people who are retiring, who've got a good pension. And, you know, they want that one timeless piece of whatever, purse, watch, they're buying it. But at the end of the day, I don't know how you can, you can't expect department stores to last the way they are today. They have to reimagine themselves, a lot less stores. There is no way they can go forward with 700 stores of JCPenney. You're going to keep that brand alive. You're down to 100 and maybe 10 that are premium. The rest, the Bay, 20 stores in Canada, that's my number. It's always been that number. I think that's where it ends.
Great. Craig, you're going to wrap it up for us? Great conversation, guys.
Thank you so much, everyone. A great conversation today about department stores and what's been happening and what might come in the future if the sector does survive. I think it will, but probably as a high-end proposition. So this has been the Business of Retail podcast. I'm Craig Patterson, joined here with Gary Newbery, George Minakakis, Christine Cohen, and David Ian Gray. Thank you so much for joining us, everyone.
You have been listening to the Business of Retail podcast, an unflinching strategic alternative to the conventional industry discourse. Thank you for joining us. For more information, please go to www.thebusinessofretail.ca.